Welcome to the Bigger Sister channel. My name is Tilly and I'm helping Estelle Lucas with research for this educational program designed to economically empower sex workers. But what does that even mean, economic empowerment? And how does that relate to sex workers? For me to answer that question, I need to share with you the insights from Estelle's original research and break down her theory on the cycle of economic disempowerment. Some background. Last year, Estelle did three major things. In May, she was awarded the 2022 Kenneth Meyer Innovation Fellowship to make the sex industry safer using technology. With this fellowship, she did two things: community building and research within the community. The research was important because although Estelle has been working in the industry for 14 years, to assume she could understand the nuances around how sex workers experience safety and danger in the workplace would be irresponsible. Sex workers know the importance of trust in this industry, and it's for this reason Estelle began this project with the community building side of things. The reality is, it doesn't matter how superb the gadgets and gizmos are, without community trust, they will not trust anything Estelle or our team create. So it was important to Estelle and the team that we start with this community confidence. It was through this community building and research that Estelle discovered that sex worker safety needs to be approached holistically and that there's no one solution that will fit us all. For Estelle, the first step to achieving safety in the workplace for sex workers in a society that has decriminalized the industry is through economic empowerment. Not only can economic empowerment help sex workers no matter what type of sex work they're doing, but it helps sex workers mitigate risk no matter how seasoned they are. And it's something that can follow you through to the rest of your days, both in and out of the industry. But how does economic empowerment relate to safety, you may be thinking? Let's start with Estelle's research. Estelle designed a qualitative study that involved one-on-one interviews with 19 participants so that she could properly determine what was the best use of her fellowship. Although she lacked a bit of a research experience, and considering this wasn't technically academic research, she still completed an ethics application so that she could ensure the integrity of the research design and safety and privacy of all the participants. The demographic of the 19 participants included underage survival or four favours sex work experience, culturally and linguistically diverse, both first generation and migrant, First Nation sex workers, workers with varying mental health conditions, varying physical or chronic disabilities. The ages ranged from 22 to 47. There was varying experiences in work settings, such as illegal or legal brothels, agencies, online, touring regionally or through the cities, or independent work, sex work or stripping. The genders included cis female, non-binary, trans male and trans femme. It included workers with less than 1 year's working experience to over 25 years working experience and those currently experiencing life crises. The interviews covered four domains: administration tasks, highlights, pain points and prototypes. She asked about contemporary practices, admin and business management, to see if there was any way she could optimize these processes or make them quicker or easier. One question she asked was, how do you track and manage the financial side of your business? She asked participants about the changes in how they conducted their work over time to measure how experience impacts how a sex worker experiences safety. For example, one of the questions asked was, how did you determine the rates and services you offer, and has this changed over time? Questions were raised about key concerns, pain points, and vulnerabilities with the work, such as workers' health or their privacy, in order to determine common trends in experiences. Not only was she trying to identify common problems, but it was important to investigate the extent of said problems. Estelle then looked at things that were working, the benefits of the job and the tools and techniques that were currently working in our favour. And she wanted to identify inherent strengths of the participants to perhaps leverage these in whatever project this fellowship ended up forming. Finally, she had those participants test three ideas that had been sitting in the back burner for main impressions and to test validity. In the end, Estelle accrued 40 hours worth of transcription, and the data processing is still being undertaken. But there are some clear-cut insights that we can share. We can tell you with full confidence that almost every sex worker struggles with either stigma, discrimination, mental health issues, financial security, or disability. None of these pain points exist within a vacuum. They are interconnected. So if we want to improve the lives and health of sex workers, we must take a holistic approach, because you cannot resolve one issue and expect the rest to be magically following suit. Let's now take a look at Estelle's research-informed theory of economic disempowerment. The cycle of economic disempowerment will help if you use a bit of imagination. So imagine that we're drawing a diagram of what we'll call the cycle of economic disempowerment. It's not a perfect one-way circle, but here's how it works. Financial insecurity is where it begins. The effects of financial insecurity are well known. It makes people vulnerable to precarity, and it's associated with a decline of health and quality of life. This is true across all industries and can affect absolutely anyone, regardless of your background. We know this because there's a number of financial literacy programs, both government-funded as well as on a corporate level, that's available to the public. However, there isn't one for sex workers yet. For sex workers experiencing financial insecurity, this can affect how a sex worker experiences safety in their workplace. For example, if you're financially insecure, you may not have the funds to start your business as a sex worker and may seek the assistance of a third party, such as a brothel or an agency. For admin, business management, security, and safety. We know this doesn't always go according to plan because third parties often have a conflict of interest when it comes to the safety and security of their workers. There will always be business decisions that will be made at the expense of the worker's safety, and the nature of these relationships is just one form of precarity which was demonstrated in the research. This is just one example of many instances where sex workers experience precarity in the workplace. In another example, say an independent sex worker goes to work in a different city and hasn't been able to cover the costs of travel. They might compromise on their screening procedures so that they can make their ends meet. As you can see, there's an association here between financial security and precarity in the workplace. The more financially secure you are, the more power you have, the more autonomy you have, the more in control you are of the conditions of your employment. In reality, this is applicable to any and all industries. I know what you're thinking, and you cannot in good conscience blame anyone for their financial insecurity. We live under the system of capitalism, and capitalism requires impoverishment to maintain its power. That makes this financial insecurity a well-calculated byproduct, and individuals alone cannot disrupt or overcome systemic barriers. It is designed to be too large, too great for one person to overturn. And this cycle is our moral failings as a society. And we know this because we replicate this experience in other industries. With other people, they also experience precarity. And subsequently, their health and quality of life also declines. Sex workers are no exception to this known fact. However, we need to factor in the third aspect to truly appreciate how the system is currently set up against sex workers. This is not a perfect circle. Stigma can go this way or that, but we're putting it here to illustrate how pervasive this experience is. The research discovered that while sex workers are generally competent, because of the stigma and discrimination, we have barriers that others don't. We have barriers in accessing information, products, support, advice, resources, or skills related to business or financial management. Now, what that means is even if a sex worker wants to be financially secure, we have very little means within the system to achieve this. everything is stacked against us. Every step of the way, stigma and far too often discrimination comes into play. Now, financial literacy is a privilege for most people, regardless of what industry you work in. But for sex workers, it's a bit different because banks don't treat us fairly and our financial capabilities are restricted by stigma and discrimination. In the above example of a sex worker who compromises their screening procedures, this might look like accepting bank transfers instead of cash. A client could show a fake receipt to fraudulently obtain consent, render the act rape by deceit, and if the sex worker seeks recourse through the banks, they'll be told the onus is on them to prove a violation occurred. The banks will wipe their hands clean and say they played no part in enabling that crime, when in reality, we have hundreds of sex workers calling them, begging them to create stronger protections and safeguards. This is just one example of many instances where sex workers can be stigmatized or discriminated against. It's unreasonable to ask individuals to become fraud detectives and dress it up as due diligence. It's much more practical to ask multi-billion dollar companies to create a technological safeguard that gives a red light to demonstrate that a payment has not come through to serve millions of citizens, not just vulnerable sex workers. Additionally, sex workers don't start life on equal footing with others, myself and the rest of the Bigger Sister team included. We have intersecting identities. We're mothers, we're migrants, we're disabled, and we're rendered more vulnerable by the stigma and discrimination. Because we have to live in secrecy, we might not be able to ask our friends or family for financial help because that just exposes us to judgment and prejudice. But it's not just that. If something bad happens at work and we don't have access to support systems because of stigma, we are left to deal with this situation in isolation. These structural barriers impact how a sex worker experiences personal finance, which we know now has an association to safety. If you don't have access to information or tools to develop financial capabilities, if you're financially excluded, the more financial stress you will experience, the more likely you are to experience precarity at work, and thus the cycle of economic disempowerment begins anew. Now, there's lots of ways that one could disrupt this cycle of economic disempowerment on an individual level. But on a more community level, our interpretation is that the systems at play gridlock sex workers into a cycle of vulnerability. Bigger Sister Channel is our proposed solution, and the Economic Empowerment Program is just one way to get out of this shit show of a reality. Let me share a little bit about my personal story. Like most people entering the industry, I entered because I needed money. I had an ex-partner who had stole a significant amount of cash from me, and at the time, I had internalized the trauma as being my own fault. I felt stupid for getting myself into the situation I found myself in and believed it was my sole responsibility to get myself out. At the time, I didn't share what happened to me with many people. And when I entered the industry, I actually didn't know anyone that was already a part of it. I had no one I could ask for tips or tricks or what to look for in a workplace and jumped right into the deep end, leaving Melbourne for Canberra, and I drove straight to a brothel. Because I was financially insecure, coupled with my lack of exposure to the industry due to stigma, I had no way of discerning precarious working conditions from safe working conditions. In the first brothel I worked at, I witnessed severe abuse from management. So severe that the owner of the first brothel I worked in is now in prison for assaulting almost every woman who walked through his door. He had been using his position of power to take advantage of people who didn't know their rights and didn't know where they could turn for help. This is one example of how stigma works. It keeps the industry insulated and disconnected from the support of other communities. In this particular workplace, as well as the abuse, there was a lot of verbal manipulation. We were constantly told by the owner and management that Every other brothel in Canberra was filled with drug-affected workers and terrible management, and that we were lucky to be working in such a good brothel. Almost everyone working at this place lacked industry experience, and so we accepted what we were told and continued to be exploited and taken advantage of. This is another example of the cycle of disempowerment. We believed that this work was as good as it could be, and we relied upon this brothel for our income. Fear was instilled in us to scare us from leaving and finding better working conditions. We were also financially controlled and limited because there were fixed rates or standards for the particular services that we offered, and we had no choice but to comply with these rules if we wanted to keep working in this so-called good brothel. This kept us gridlocked into the cycle of disempowerment. Perhaps it was my age, but I entered this industry at 26. I'd worked in a range of jobs and industries before becoming a sex worker. And even though I lacked industry experience, it was only a few weeks before I decided that this kind of treatment was unacceptable. Being a sex worker is constant risk assessment. Will I be safe if I disclose my job to this person? Will this person make assumptions about who I am based on my job? Will this person understand the importance of privacy if I disclose my job to them? The endless questions around safety and security exist for us as individuals once we take on this job. I could go on with many more examples just from my life alone, but I think you get the idea. No matter how much I address the financial insecurity to avoid the precarity, this keeps me back at square one, stigma and discrimination. And I am rendered vulnerable and gridlocked into the cycle of economic disempowerment despite my best individual efforts. How then do we break out of the cycle of economic disempowerment? In the next video, we'll go through the solution that addresses all of these areas.